Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This past weekend, a bomb exploded in Lower Manhattan, leaving dozens injured. More bombs were discovered in New York and New Jersey, and after a manhunt that ended in a shootout, authorities took a suspect into custody, Ahmad Khan Rahami. Questions remain about motive, radicalization, and more. This hour on Point, the bombings in New York and New Jersey, and what we know now. You can join us on air or online. What caught your attention after the bombings in New York and New Jersey and after this weekend's stabbing in Minnesota? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first this hour from New York is Mark Santora. He is a reporter at the New York Times. He's been covering the bombings. Mark, welcome to On Point. I know you're on deadline. Thanks so much for being here.
Sure. How are you doing?
So the suspect in the bombings, Ahmad Rahami, in custody, apprehended on the stoop of a bar after this gunfight with police. What's the latest that you know in the investigation?
Obviously they're looking into whatever contacts he might have had, whatever help, if he had any at all, trying to understand motive and why he might have chosen the targets he did. Essentially, all the hard work of the investigation still needs to be done.
Did he act alone? Are investigators looking for accomplices at this point?
I think it would be way too early to say if he acted alone. There's some people we've spoken to who said the level of sophistication of the bombs, in Chelsea in particular, were sophisticated enough to give them concern, saying that it's not just the kind of thing you can learn on the internet, but that you would need some help with. So I think it's an open question.
What about the handwritten note found in that plastic bag?
We actually don't believe, at least our sources tell us, there wasn't a note there. So, this is what happens, after a few days, you start to get contradictory information. But what we are looking at, there's a bigger focus on the trips he made to Pakistan and what those trips might have been, who he might have been in contact with, his brother being still overseas, if he had any links or any knowledge. There's a lot of unanswered questions.
So is there evidence he did receive training or guidance while he was on those trips to Pakistan and Afghanistan, spent a year, I guess, in Quetta, which is a Taliban stronghold?
No evidence of training that we know of, but what there is some suggestion of from people who knew him, friends and neighbors and other people, is that he came back somewhat changed. Again, what that means exactly, what that translated to in his life, it's a little hard to say, but it's sort of, you've seen it with some of these other cases where someone takes a trip overseas, comes back, and they're described as changed and they're withdrawn from their friends and their behavior, what had been Western and typically normal, sort of they get become more withdrawn and other things. So I think that's one of the things we're going to learn more about today.
So the Rahami family owned a chicken restaurant in New Jersey. What can you tell us about this immigrant family's fractious relationship with their neighbors there?
Well, so yesterday we found out quite a bit about, how when this restaurant's been there for 10 years, when it opened, it was running 24 hours a day. That led to become sort of a hangout late at night. Some of the neighbors would get upset. The family decided they wanted to keep it open, and the city decided they would pass an ordinance trying to force them to close it at 10 p.m. The family didn't comply, apparently, which led to more confrontations. So there's a fractured relationship, but even more interesting, actually, what we're learning today is about the relationship within the family itself. It seems that the father and the son might not have had that great of a relationship. So again, we're still trying to piece these things together and figure out if they have any broader meaning into what actually happened.
Also, some harassment, Mark, in the neighborhood. I'm reading quotes here, neighbors saying Muslims make too much trouble in this country. I mean, there are intricacies in this story, certainly.
Yeah, and again, that's one of the dangers with these things. I think, first of all, the family filed a suit against the city, which claimed that they felt harassed.
Mm-hmm.
The exact nature of that, I think, is a bit unclear still. So I think that's one of the areas we're all going to be looking into.
So what about the unusual crowdsourcing efforts that investigators used to track down the suspect? Twitter, text alerts, pushing up pictures of the suspect on Facebook. This was unprecedented.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been doing this a long time. We've never seen a an alert sent to millions of people in the region in a manhunt. I mean, I think we last time we saw it was, you know, during some big weather events, you know, a hurricane warning or a blizzard warning. But this is the first time a message like that's been pushed out to millions of New Yorkers who all woke up to this, you know, pretty shocking message. And we're all familiar with the name Rahami by 8 a.m. yesterday morning.
Mm. The apprehension of Rahami happened very quickly, right? Some 50 hours after the bombings. Quite remarkable.
Yeah, and I think as they learned more throughout Saturday night into Sunday, they grew more and more concerned, and the hunt grew in urgency. And I think the ending on a you know, a rain slick street in Linden, New Jersey, was pretty dramatic in itself too, where he's found, you know, after causing all this sowing terror across two states, he's found sleeping in the doorway of this sort of nondescript bar. When he's roused by a police officer, he opens fire. There's a gun battle. He runs down the street, firing indiscriminately, both the officer and passing cars. He's finally shot three times and taken into custody. The police officer he shot in the stomach luckily was wearing a vest, and his wounds were not fatal, and another officer also not fatal wounds. So he's run to custody. It's unclear if he's cooperating right now, but I think, again, the fact that they caught him alive is another thing that will hopefully help investigators better understand what his motivation might have been. And it's got to be said, by the way, that we don't believe he has a lawyer yet. So, again, everything we're saying here is what police believe he did.
Hmm. Mark Santora has been covering the bombings in New York and New Jersey for The New York Times. Speaks to us from New York. Mark, thanks so much again for your time.
Thanks so much.
Since we spoke with Mark Santora, he has come out with a new story in The New York Times that Ahmad Khan Rahami's father told police in 2014 that his son was a terrorist, which led to scrutiny by federal agents. Here is New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio at a press conference yesterday saying that while the investigation is still ongoing, he is confident about calling the bombings in New York and New Jersey a terrorist act.
Based on the information we have now, we have every reason to believe this was an act of terror. We will be going into some detail, and there is still a long investigation ahead, but now we have, as I said, every reason to believe this was an act of terror.
And here's President Obama speaking yesterday about the bombings in New York and New Jersey. He said that the terrorist goal is to instill fear and that Americans need to resist that fear.
Even as we have to be vigilant and aggressive, both in preventing senseless acts of violence, but also making sure that we find those who carry out such acts and bring them to justice. We all have a role to play as citizens in making sure that we don't succumb to that fear.
I'm happy now to welcome with me in the studio J.M. Berger. He is fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University and associate fellow at the International Center for Counterterrorism at The Hague. He is also co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror. J.M. Berger, always great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So what strikes you about this investigation so far?
I think that, you know, this case really highlights the fact that as we see an uptick in terrorism, we see more and more incidents, that there's really no typical kind of attack anymore. This was unusual in a couple of different ways. First, the placement of the bombs seems kind of erratic. Secondly, the fact that the suspect didn't attempt to provoke a confrontation with police or flee, but was simply found near his house sleeping. Mm-hmm. It's very unusual. And the type of explosive that was used in the attack is one that is a little bit different than what we've seen in some of these previous ones. So there's, you know, a lot of questions. We still don't really know what's going on, but, you know, I think it's just sort of striking that this is, you know, that we've seen just a variety of new developments in these cases over the last couple of years.
What does that say to you, J.M., that this guy's sitting on a stoop of a bar outside, you know, near his home?
I don't know. I mean, we're going to have to wait and see. It could point to him not being in a particularly good state of mind, but to build the number of devices that he did and deploy them is not something that you do overnight. It's not like you have a nervous breakdown and snap and build 10 pipe bombs in a weekend.
So what is the sophistication of these two very different types of explosives devices tell us?
Well, what it looks like to me is that these were fairly ambitious bombs. They do reflect designs that we've seen in the kind of the homemade bomb market promulgated by Inspire magazine, mostly Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The number of devices and the placement of them is unusual, is what's unusual. To really, like, we haven't seen a case recently where a single person, especially if it is a single person, built so many devices and attempted to deploy them in multiple locations over a short period of time.
So does the handiwork of the bombs then raise the possibility that the suspect probably or may have received help from someone else, more experienced than he?
It raises the possibility. You know, it's well within the realm of possibility that this guy could have done this on his own. But we do have his travel to Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is raising questions for a lot of people. And, you know, further investigation is going to illuminate that. But I certainly expect that there's going to be intense scrutiny on those trips.
So what about the radicalization on those trips? You know, reports that he came back different, both in appearance and in religiosity.
Well, we do see that kind of thing. I mean, a change in religiosity is something that we sometimes see in these cases. Sometimes we don't. People can become very religious without turning into terrorists. But, you know, it's certainly – you can point to other cases that are similar to this. You know, the indications are that after his 2013 trip to the AFPAC region is when he came back and seemed different to people. And, you know, like I said, the type of bombs that he used and the number of bombs he used shows that this was premeditated. This is not a spur of the moment. It's not somebody snapping.
I want to play some sound here. Here's Hardiner Baines. He is the one who called the police when he found the suspect in New York, sleeping in the doorway of his bar. He spoke to CNN's Anderson Cooper yesterday.
That's the time when I saw his face, when he removed his hoodie. It, like, kind of struck me because I was watching CNN on my laptop, and you guys have his picture on a side, like a PIP, you know, on a side.
Right.
So I said, this guy looked similar, like very familiar to same, like a same guy, you know.
And David Ayers was working in his auto shop when a shootout broke out between the suspect and police in Linden, New Jersey. Here he is describing that moment.
They're exchanging shots, you know, we're running, we're looking for some cover, we're sticking a video camera out because nobody wants to stand in the line of fire or anything. It was pretty surreal, to be honest with you.
We are talking about the bombings in New York and New Jersey this hour. Also, the knife attack this weekend in Minnesota. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. The sound of a shootout between the suspect in the New York, New Jersey bombing, Ahmad Khan Rahami, and police in Linden, New Jersey. We're talking about the attacks this past weekend in New York, New Jersey, and in Minnesota, and you can join the conversation. Are you worried that the government cannot stop all the individuals plotting terror within the United States? Are you on high alert in crowds at big events or not? Here is New York Congressman Peter King speaking on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday about the threat of terrorism facing Americans.
These threats are real. They're going to continue. Whether or not this turns out to be overseas terrorism, whether it's domestic terrorism or any terrorism at all, it's a wake-up call, another one, as to how vulnerable we are.
My guest this hour, J.M. Berger, fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University, associate fellow at the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague. Joining me now from Washington is Peter Bergen. He is vice president at New America, a Washington think tank and national security analyst at CNN. He is author of United States of Jihad, in Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Peter, welcome back to On Point. Always great to have you as well.
Thank you.
So what strikes you about this investigation so far?
Well, let's start with the fact that Rahami almost fits perfectly the profile of American homegrown terrorists that I generated for my recent book. I looked at 360 cases of jihadi terrorism since 9/11. Some of them are relatively trivial cases, and some are very serious cases. And the profile that emerges is overwhelmingly they're American citizens. And of course, we've heard a lot of political rhetoric about refugees and immigrants and foreigners coming into the United States and conducting these kinds of attacks, and it's all nonsense. Every lethal attack in the United States has been carried out by an American citizen or legal permanent resident, and four-fifths of the 360 cases I looked at were carried out by American citizens or legal permanent residents. Also, Rahami fits the profile in other ways. His age is 28, he's married, and he has a daughter. These are not the young hotheads of popular imagination. He looks very similar to somebody else who fits this profile almost perfectly, Omar Mateen, who carried out the attack in Orlando, killing 49 in the most lethal terrorist attack since 9/11, who was also married and also had a son, and was also an American citizen of Afghan descent who was born in the New York City area. So the profile is very much a profile that unfortunately we've come to know. The question, of course, is motivation, and we still don't really know what the motivation is here. What was the precipitating factor, as you and J.M. Berger were just discussing? Was he radicalized in Afghanistan, Pakistan? We've seen in the past that people radicalize very quickly. If we look at the Orlando attack or even the Nice attack, these weren't things that were gestating for years. They came rather more quickly. So certainly the travel is interesting overseas to Pakistan and Afghanistan. But religiosity is not necessarily a precursor for becoming somebody who kills complete strangers.
Mm-hmm. So Rahami was an American citizen, as you say. Was he on law enforcement's radar, given what we've learned about his travel this week? Should he have been?
I think the short answer is no. I mean, it's easy to kind of Monday morning quarterback this. But travel to South Asia by military-age males is pretty common. In fact, I go there all the time. That doesn't mean I'm a terrorist. So, I think we have to be careful about saying, well, simply because you've traveled to Pakistan or Afghanistan, mm-hmm. that therefore this makes you a suspect. And in fact, usually what's interesting, one area that this is not typical, is typically when somebody conducts a significant terrorist attack in this country, they're often on the radar of law enforcement in one way or another. Omar Mateen, the Orlando attacker, was interviewed by the FBI twice. Major Nidal Hassan, who killed 13 at Fort Hood, Texas, was a subject of FBI interest. So I would say usually somebody who does this kind of thing has generated some law enforcement interest. After all, the FBI is mounting 1,000 investigations in 50 states. But what this does underline is that occasionally somebody slips below the radar, and in this case, Rahami did.
J.M. Berger, Rahami was given secondary screening after his overseas trips to Pakistan and Afghanistan. What does that mean?
Typically, if you travel to certain countries where, there's a known issue with terrorism, so Iraq, Afghanistan, you will be asked additional questions and sort of they'll take a closer look at you when you're coming in. It's usually meant to intercept somebody who's coming in, with a direct intention to do harm. And I believe, where there's a couple of years space between his last trip here and the attacks. So, he didn't necessarily come back with a specific intent or a specific association. But they'll ask additional questions. They don't just let you walk through generally.
Let's get some callers in here. Sam in Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your time. And my question is, I know a little while ago your guest was saying we don't know what motivated this particular person, but what are terrorists like ISIS after, such that once they achieve what they want to achieve, they no longer feel the need for terrorist attacks? Because I think if we don't understand our supposed enemies, we don't understand them at our peril.
Mm. Sam, thanks so much. Peter Bergen.
Well, I mean, the caller asked a good question, because the big question is why. And having spent 2.5 years looking at hundreds of these cases, the why actually gets harder and harder to answer. Because take the Boston Marathon bombers, who seem to have to some degree inspired Rahami. If Jahar Sani, if the younger brother, was on the show and you asked him why, he would have a very half-baked answer about American foreign policy. He wasn't an observant Muslim. He was smoking marijuana and drinking and chasing women. And so when you dig into the why, there may be some kind of mix of opposition to American foreign policy, some kind of a notion that ISIS is creating an Islamic utopia in the Middle East. But usually also you find that the person is using this ideology as sort of an excuse to allow himself to be a hero in his own story. So many of these men, they're almost invariably men. Often you find a personal disappointment, some kind of loss in life, We don't know this episode with the chicken restaurant where there was this conflict with authorities. Was this a precipitation to turn him against the United States? We just don't know. But as we dig, we will know a lot more in about a week. And then we'll be able to say, well, this personal loss or personal disappointment was kind of the turning point. And so many of these cases, we find a loss of a job, a divorce, you know, the feeling of discrimination, something precipitates mm-hmm. this turn to violence. Mm.
CNN is just reporting here that the New York and New Jersey bombing suspect's notebook had ramblings about the late al-Qaeda spokesman Anwar al-Awlaki. Law enforcement officials are saying the notebook also referred to the Boston Marathon bombing. J.M. Berger.
Well, Anwar al-Awlaki is a figure who's inspired a lot of cases where somebody took action on their own or mostly on their own. And so that would be consistent with the kind of profile we see. The marathon bombers also were familiar with al-Awlaki and fired up by his materials. And he was killed in a U.S. drone strike a couple of years ago. But, you know, many of his lectures and live on the internet. You can go online and find, you know, hours and hours of stuff. He was a prolific cleric. And so, you know, it's not surprising to me to hear that.
Ali is in Austin, Texas. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yes. From a Muslim community's perspective, a lot of us actually know where the radicalization comes from. And, you know, we feel like at least I feel that, you know, we're just reacting to the events, but not concentrating on actually, you know, not creating, you know, preventing more of these people from coming and being radicalized.
So as someone who's part of the Muslim community, Ali, then, what do you feel is the answer? How do you, as a community, feel you should be or could be more proactive in fighting against this type of radicalization?
So majority of the people that actually have done this, whether it's, you know, homegrown or international, whether it's ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or Boko Haram, mm-hmm. they all believe in a very stringent interpretation of Islam mm-hmm. Called Wahhabism or Salafism. And that version of Islam is only propagated by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Qatar, these three countries that's their core belief, where, you know, if you're not with us,
you're against us.
Worth dying for.
Yeah. Ali, thank you so much. I'm going to let J.M. Berger jump in on that point. You're nodding your head.
I think, you know, as far as the Saudi influence on this, it sort of boils down to it's complicated. Prior to 9/11, you could draw a pretty straight line between Saudi proselytization of this extreme form of Islam and jihadist movements because the same people were doing that stuff. What we're seeing in the post 9/11 environment is that, you know, the Saudis are still promulgating this version of the religion. They are somewhat, you know, institutionally and as a broad culture less involved in really fomenting jihadism because it's starting to hit a little bit too close to home for them. But, you know, they certainly do have a role in this. But I will say that when you talk to people inside communities, whether it's a community that's bounded geography or by religion or by culture, people's perceptions of what causes radicalization often don't line up with what, you know, research and studies tell us. Mm-hmm. When you're in a community and you see that there's a bunch of unhappy, unemployed young people in your community, it's natural for you to blame that. But when you look at it, you know, when you sort of zoom up to the 60,000 foot level, what you find is that, you know, any given community is dissimilar from another community and the profiles of people inside the community are different.
Peter Bergen, do you agree?
Totally. You know, the philosopher Immanuel Kant said, from the crooked timber of humanity, not a straight thing is made. And I think that's a very useful admonition to journalists, historians, and sociologists that human beings are very complex. And the more you know about these stories, the more personal these decisions are. I want to return, though, to Anwar al-Awlaki, because for all the discussion of ISIS and ISIS-inspired attacks in this country, research that I performed with my team at New America shows that in 57 cases since Anwar al-Awlaki was killed in a drone strike 5 years ago, his writings and sermons in the United States were present in these cases. And so it turns out that even in death, Anwar al-Awlaki's ideas are quite current. And now we have another case in which he seems to have played an inspirational role, which, of course, is interesting also because he's an American citizen who was born in New Mexico, who preached in both Northern Virginia and also in San Diego.
Let's go back to the phones. Greg in Syracuse, New York. Hi, Greg. You're on the air with J.M. Berger and Peter Bergen and J.M. Berger. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to share a comment or reflection about this whole thing, and that is that as we see and feel the tension, and as the these events seem to become more common, I think it's just important for all of us to sort of keep in mind that the way we respond to these attacks, the way that we, even as individuals who might not have anything to do with government, policy decisions, to keep in mind the notion that we can't respond with all this hatred and vitriol, which is fueling the attacks in the first place. That leads to just erroneous miscarriages of justice, like what happened in World War II with Japanese internment. And obviously, on the campaign trail, mm-hmm. one side, we're hearing quite a bit of that.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to the politics of that in the next break. Greg, I appreciate so much your call up in Syracuse. Let's go to Wes in Nashville, Tennessee. Wes, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Wes. Go ahead. How about Larry in Charlottesville, Virginia? Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi. My comment is this. Intelligence in the law enforcement do a great job, but it's not enough. At the end of the day, war has been declared on the citizens of the United States, and we are responsible for our own safety. For that reason, I carry a gun everywhere I go. I know it might not help out in a bombing situation, but with a man with a knife or a gun, I've got an advantage, or at least an equal shot of making it through it. My comment is, why doesn't more Americans, citizens, carry concealed or open so we can even the playing field?
It's another debate, another hour, I think. Larry, thank you. J.M. Berger, do you want to respond?
I don't really have any comment on that.
You know what?
Actually, I do.
Okay. Peter, go ahead.
You're 3,000 times more likely to be killed by an American carrying a gun than you are to be killed by a jihadist terrorist in this country. So this notion that if we were all better armed, somehow we'd be safer is absolutely ridiculous. Since 9/11, in this country, 94 people have been killed by jihadi terrorists. In the same time period, 150,000 people have been murdered by fellow Americans with guns. And so if we're going to have a debate about this issue, it's clear that the math is completely wrong on the other side of this.
Peter Bergen, before we go to break here, let me ask you about a comment Senator Lindsey Graham made, urging the Obama administration to consider holding Ahmad Rouhani as an enemy combatant.
It's the most ridiculous observation possible. I mean, if you are an enemy combatant, the likelihood of you actually being tried is infinitesimally small. We've held 800 foreigners as enemy combatants. 8 of them have gone to trial. So you have a 1 in 100 chance of actually going to trial. In the United States, the federal terrorism conviction rate in these trials is 100%. There's just no and also, leaving aside all the constitutional issues, I'm just from an efficacy point of view, this idea makes no sense at all.
But is it for intelligence gathering purposes?
Well, there's a public exception safety rule, and we're not giving him his Miranda rights precisely for this reason. And we did the same thing, by the way, with a foreign citizen, the underwear bomber, who's Nigerian. We didn't read him his rights initially because we were concerned that there were potentially other aspects of the plot. So he will not be read his rights while this public safety exception is still in progress. And once they've satisfied themselves that he acted alone, they will read him as Miranda rights.
Would he even qualify in this case, J.M. Berger?
I think this discussion of the enemy combatant status is really just an effort to create the appearance of toughness, and in practice it is not really all that tough. If you look at the fact that we have, the perpetrators of September 11th are sitting in Guantanamo waiting for a trial, more than, you know, 15 years later, that's not a very good system. That's not a tough system.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the aftermath of the bombings in New York and New Jersey and the attack in Minnesota. You can join the conversation. Muslim Americans, are you worried about discrimination, about retaliation? We're speaking this hour with J.M. Berger, fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. He is associate fellow at the International Center for Counterterrorism at The Hague. Also, Peter Bergen, vice president at the think tank New America and national security analyst at CNN, author of United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Here's Hillary Clinton on Monday saying that the bombings in New York and New Jersey demonstrate the need for vigilance.
This threat is real, but so is our resolve. Americans will not cower. We will prevail. We will defend our country, and we will defeat the evil, twisted ideology of the terrorists.
And here's Donald Trump speaking yesterday on Fox and Friends. He praised Israel's use of profiling and said that the U.S. should profile people as well.
They'll profile. They profile. They see somebody that's suspicious. They will profile. They will take that person in. They'll check out. Do we have a choice? Look what's going on. Do we really have a choice?
So Donald Trump calling for racial profiling to effectively fight the threat of terrorism in the U.S. Hillary Clinton criticizing Trump's rhetoric, saying his comments have been used online to recruit terrorists. What's your response first? Peter Bergen, speak to the politics of this. Who's hitting the message here that's resonating with voters? Who's leading on this?
Well, I'd like to speak to the facts rather than the politics. When we look at ISIS recruits, 117 recruits from in the United States, we found a very interesting thing that suggests a profile wouldn't make a lot of sense. They come from 23 states. They fit no ethnic profile. I mean, obviously, they're all Sunni Muslims, but are we suggesting that we're just going to arrest the 3 million Sunni Muslims in this country? Donald Trump has said a lot of things, most of which don't make any sense from a factual point of view. I'm not talking about the politics. Rahami, returning to the matter at hand, he came to this country 20 years ago as a 7-year-old kid. Are we supposed to ask a 7-year-old kid if he has militant ideological leanings 20 years in his future when he arrives at JFK?
Mm-hmm.
These ideas, they may sort of make sense, but they're sort of ideas that your kind of uncle at Thanksgiving trots out and says, look, I've got the perfect solution. You just look at them for like 2 minutes and you realize actually none of this makes any sense. Leaving aside the whole constitutional issue about whether any of this would be legal to make some kind of religious test or other kind of test.
Here's Hillary Clinton speaking yesterday saying that Donald Trump has helped terror groups by broadly denouncing Muslims.
We know that Donald Trump's comments have been used online for recruitment of terrorists. We've heard that from former CIA director Michael Hayden, who made it a very clear point when he said Donald Trump is being used as a recruiting sergeant for the terrorists.
And here's Donald Trump at a rally in Florida yesterday. He expressed his frustration with the, quote, amazing treatment that the alleged New York and New Jersey bomber will receive in the hospital and the American legal system.
He will be taken care of by some of the best doctors in the world. He will be given a fully modern and updated hospital room. And he'll probably even have room service, knowing the way our country is. And on top of all of that, he will be represented by an outstanding lawyer.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo responded to Trump on CNN yesterday, expressing his frustration that we just heard there. At one point in the clip, the audio cuts out, but here's that.
We have a system of jurisprudence. You're innocent until proven guilty. You have a right to counsel. You have a right to hospitalization if you're ill. That is our system. And it's what makes this country special and what makes this country great.
Jay Amberger, what are you hearing all that?
Well, you know, the latter comments that we just listened to, I think, you know, are really kind of unserious. You know, discussion of whether, you know, a criminal suspect should have a lawyer or be treated for injuries is just kind of ridiculous. To the point that ISIS is using Trump's language in recruiting, I mean, I think that that is true, but I think it's also kind of a complicated issue. So, you know, ISIS uses any politician that makes anti-Muslim statements. They will pull stuff from various sources, sometimes very low profile people. But the most prominent figure in ISIS recruitment propaganda is President Obama, who is attacking them with airstrikes and you know, taking really active steps against them. The U.S. president will always have that. What I'm concerned about is that, you know, is that we're creating a toxic environment in this country where you have, you know, an extremist attack and then you have an extremist response and then there's continued escalation and things just get uglier and uglier. And so, you know, I'm less concerned with ISIS using Trump's rhetoric and more concerned about how Trump's rhetoric is landing in the United States.
Extremist attack, extremist response. Peter Bergen, do you see it like that?
Yeah, I mean, Trump's rise is partly as a result of his stance on Muslim immigration. But, you know, I mean, some of the, as JM referenced, I mean, we gave the Nazis, war criminals at Nuremberg, very good lawyers. In fact, some of them were acquitted. And of course, you know, so this is, I mean, the idea that somehow we shouldn't give medical treatment to somebody who's going to face trial. By the way, he couldn't face trial if he was not able to attend physically the courtroom and was deemed medically unfit. So this is just part of our process. The idea that we wouldn't do this is crazy.
Let's get Mandy in here from Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Mandy. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted just to speak to the treatment that this young man's family received prior to this incident. It, from what I'm reading and hearing, it appears that they were, you know, targeted as Muslims in their neighborhood, and nasty things were said about them because they were Muslim. Never mind that they kept the restaurant open late or whatever, but they were Muslim. Underneath it all was because of their faith. And I think that you know, could, I don't know, could have played a part in this young man's frustrations. And I'm thinking, what a message that gives to the rest of us. We need to look at how we deal with people who are different than us. And I think that's my fear with what was said just a few moments before about Mr. Trump's rhetoric is only feeding that fuel of not accepting, not being tolerant, and not trying to understand.
Mandy, thank you. Appreciate your call. Good thoughts there. Let's go to Denise in Iowa. Denise, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I agree with Trump. I mean, when Hillary Clinton says we won't back down, we won't. The Constitution was we the people for the people. I don't think we need to digress from that. And we've been using racial profiling across the country to police our nation anyway. In each one of our communities. It's been highlighted all over the media the past couple of years. So why would we change that policy if we felt like it was the safest way to keep our neighborhood safe?
Denise, thank you. Peter Bergen, your response? What do you say?
Yeah, the New York Police Department did a form of racial profiling, sending New York City cops into places, mosques and places where Muslims gathered. And they settled suits without admitting any wrongdoing, but paying the cost of the plaintiffs because, you know, it is part of the First Amendment. It's the First Amendment. It's not the 56th Amendment. The country was founded on freedom of religion. And the idea that you would profile based on people's religion is not constitutional. And it has, you know, it suffered you know, the New York Police Department doesn't do this. Bill de Blasio, the mayor, said we will not do this anymore. So this kind of thing won't survive constitutional tests and hasn't survived them already.
Dave in Buffalo, New York, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I want to reiterate Mr. Bergen's comments from a few minutes ago. When talking about extremism, lately a lot of these lone wolf attackers seemingly have been looking for fame. And I wonder, for you and for journalists in general, there's a contradiction between fighting the lone wolf seeking fame and the 24/7 coverage that they get on the media, and they seem contradictory to me. How do we deal with that?
Dave, it's an excellent point. Are we fanning the flames here by talking about this for an hour? I mean, 24-hour news coverage is one thing. Jay Amberger?
Well, I think that, you know, we have to cover these things when they happen, but the fame-seeking piece of this is really very important, especially as we see waves of sort of copycat kind of things. When the more the stuff gets pumped into the ecosystem, the 24/7 news cycle, the social media cycle, it's going to inspire more violence. And there's not an easy solution to this. I think that we can do some things to offset the fame-seeking piece of this. And most importantly, I think, you know, keeping these attacks in perspective. You know, if you look at how, for instance, France 24 covered the terrorist attacks mm-hmm. in Paris mm-hmm. relative to how CNN covered them, you know, there was less hyperventilation. They took a break to do weather and sports. You know, it wasn't the only thing that anybody talked about. And I think that, you know, in an ideal world, we would find ways to talk about this that acknowledges the gravity and the seriousness of the situation without turning it into a national obsession.
Peter Bergen, is there a smart way to cover this? Is it important to cover it as we are?
Well, since I work for CNN, I will take this opportunity to try and defend where I work. And, you know, yes, 24/7 news cycle. You know, and also, by the way, these are news events. You know, do the thought experiment where we didn't cover Paris or we didn't cover 9/11. I mean, it's an absurd thought experiment because these are huge news stories and they're intended to be. But I do think, echoing something that JM was sort of gesturing at, which is, I think there's been an increasing understanding amongst journalists to not mention the perpetrator's name, as much as possible. But of course, you can't avoid it in certain contexts, to maybe not use his picture, to focus more on the victims. And I, you know, have been covering this for for a long time. And I've noticed in the last 3 or 4 years, even like on CNN last night, Anderson Cooper said that he would be trying to avoid mentioning the perpetrator's name as much as possible. But, you know, in certain contexts, you've got to mention it. So I think there is an understanding that we can do better and should do better. But again, these are significant news stories. And when a bomb goes off in Manhattan, which could have killed a lot of people, which is the capital of the world's media, it's hard not to cover it.
Dave, thank you so much for the call. Jay Amberger, from a national security perspective, how many radicalized individuals do you suspect the FBI is tracking at this point?
Well, the FBI has indicated that there's a number something like 1,000. And out of that group, relatively few of them are going to actually carry out attacks. But, you know, what we see in this weekend, what we've seen in other attacks is that, you know, only a handful of people can make a very big disruption in our society. So, you know, one thing that's a little bit unclear when you get these numbers from the government is that it's what they're based on. So we've seen like a lot of vagueness and inconsistency in sort of the estimates we get from various parts of the government, not just the FBI. So, you know, that's not a number you can necessarily take to the bank. You know, the other question that's sort of out there is that, you know, we have done a lot of stuff to sort of try and get at this problem, to try and cut off some of the access and spread of propaganda online. And, you know, one question that I'm hoping to look at in the next couple of months is, out of the attacks we've seen this year, how many of these are people who are in the pipeline? You know, how many had been radicalized 2 or 3 years ago or had social contacts that they established 2 or 3 years ago and are only carrying out an attack now versus new recruits coming into the system? So that's one way we'll be able to evaluate the effectiveness of what we're doing.
Ken in Farmington, Connecticut. You're on the air, Ken. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much, Jane, for taking my call.
Yes.
I have two questions, one for Mr. Bergen and Mr. Berger. In 2004, Donald Rumsfeld asked Pentagon to make a study to find out the root causes of terrorism. And if my memory is still correct, one of the root causes of the terrorism is that terrorists don't hate our freedom, but they hated United States foreign policy. And second question to Jane is that both Mr. Bergen and Mr. Berger seem to agree very much together. So I would like to see other journalists who have alternative views, such as Jeremy Scahill or academics such as Noam Chomsky, on the show to get different points of view. So I think it'll serve the review listeners very well.
All right, Ken. I appreciate it, and I hear it. Point taken. We'll talk about that today. Peter Bergen, will you speak to Ken's first point about the root causes of all this? You've studied this extensively.
Well, let's start with the fact that there are lots of people who object to American foreign policy, but only a tiny, tiny minority will go and kill complete strangers because of this as part of a mix of motivations. So the idea that somehow, you know, if we waved a magic wand over American foreign policy, this thing would disappear, I think, is a little naive. In addition, I would say that the motivations of terrorists change over time. I would say a very big motivation now, and JM has written an entire very good book on the subject. I mean, ISIS doesn't talk about American foreign policy as much as it talks about a global cosmic war with the Shia and the coming of a Mahdi who's going to, you know, be the kind of the end times of Islam and all sorts of other things that have not that much to do with American foreign policy. So, you know, there is no single cause, no kind of magic answer to the question that the caller raises.
Jay and Berger, we've got 30 seconds left. Final thoughts.
I've studied, you know, kind of root causes pretty extensively in terms of looking at how we counter violent extremism. And, you know, what we find is that if you zoom in on one community, you might be able to come up with some answers about that community. But when you try and look at it longitudinally and across, you know, broader spectrum, there is no single answer to that question.
Jay Amberger is fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University, co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror. JM, it's really great to have you always. Thanks. Peter Bergen, vice president of the think tank New America and author of United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. As well, Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
Get the conversation on our podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the Trump Foundation. We look at that. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.